Mr. Peter Berry, Real 5. Now, can you tell us a bit about the Comet? Because that was the tank that your unit was equipped with, wasn't
it? That's right. But basically, the Comet is a very good tank. I think it was first introduced in late 1944, after the Normandy campaign. And I believe the 23rd Hussars were the first people to have them. And they were up near the German border, so it must have been fairly late 1944 when they were first introduced. And they thought they were absolutely wonderful. It was a medium tank. It had a road speed of about 35 miles an hour, which was fast. It had a super engine called the Merlin. What was that, 12 cylinders or something like that? It was based on the Spitfire engine anyway. It was this, a modification of the Spitfire engine. Very good engine. The problem with Comets in Hong Kong was that they were very, very old. I mean, they were presumably some of the original ones, and therefore some of them, we don't know how old they were, but some of them must have been 10 years old. They'd done, therefore, a few miles, so I don't know what the history of them particularly was. In a lot of ways, Hong Kong wasn't very good tank country, and I think, honestly, they had Comets there for flag waving, for showing the flag and looking at the might of the British Army more than anything else. Had there actually been serious fighting in Hong Kong, had we had to defend it against a Chinese invasion across the border, their gun would have been useful in certain circumstances, but I don't think they would have been particularly useful in informal attack situations. We had some good training areas there, and we could bomb around in tanks on those training areas very well. They were, in a sense, almost reminiscent of some of the territory around Aldershot and Farnham and places like that in Surrey, with fewer trees, very dusty, horrible sort of orange dust everywhere in the hot weather. But they were in appalling condition. That was the problem. And we were constantly patching these things up. I mean, most of our working life in the regiment was trying to mend tanks. I mean, we tried to do quite a lot of it in our own lines, in our own tank park. But tanks were always being shipped down to command workshops and back again to have major repairs done to them, and so on and so forth. And, I mean, I became commander of one troop, A Squadron, 3 or 4 days after I got there, because the troop commander had been injured in doing something else. And so I had, therefore, four tanks, which is what a troop had. When I arrived, they weren't there. I mean, I didn't actually have a tank for about a fortnight, I don't think, and then they started reappearing. But I can't remember many occasions, and they were certainly highlighted in the diary I used to keep at the time, that when I had four tanks on the road fit, it was a very rare occasion. It really hardly ever happened. So it was depressing in the sense, because basically they were good. The gun worked well, and they had a Beza armament as well, a crew of four. And
what were the crew roles? Do you remember what everybody did?
Yes, I sat in the top, in the turret, as the commander. There was a gunner down below my feet. I used to put my feet on his shoulders when they got tired. There was a driver, of course, and there was another bloke down on the right-hand side who manned the wirelesses. So there were three of us in the turret. Occasionally, there was a fifth man in the co-driver seat in the front who operated the Beza, but most of the time, the Beza was operated by the main gunner because he was either firing Beza or was firing main armament, one or the other, not usually both at the same time, depending on the circumstances, of course.
And what did you actually have to do as a tank commander and troop commander? In the tank? I mean, how did you maintain control?
Well, we had two wireless sets, which were also in a disastrous state condition. I mean, as bad as the tanks. This seems to be the history of all my army reading, bad radio connections.
Were they 19 set?
We had a 19 set, which was the Russian set, which had Russian writing all over the front of it, which was the set where we communicated with other members of the troop and with the squadron leader and up to it. That's the regimental or squadron net was on the 19 set. And we had an 88 set, which was the intercom within the tank. We had one microphone. As a commander, you had one microphone, with a thing called a Pressel switch on it, and you had to remember to click it one way or the other according to which set you were on. And of course there were hilarious moments, which the story must have been told hundreds of times, when you were on the 19th set instead of on your talking to your tank commander, and hysterically, and even more hysterically, saying, "Driver left, driver left, driver left," and the whole squadron could hear you saying it. And everybody belly laughed as a result of it. And, of course, your driver couldn't hear you saying it, so he didn't go left. And so various shambles used to happen as a result of it. It cost you a pint when you got back to the mess in the evening if you did that. You learnt not to do it.
And any other role as a commander? So you use your intercom to guide the tank.
Yeah. Oh yes.
Did you have any weapon in the yourself? I mean, was there a .5 machine gun, or was that?
No, I didn't have a weapon. I had a pistol, but you know, a sort of regular army issue for subaltern. But I didn't fire a beezer or get involved with the firing of the gun at all. That was all.
No, no. I just
wondered
if there was a one on the. Sometimes I used to have.
Yeah, we had round the outside of the turret. There were sockets for smoke canisters, and we had smoke bombs, which were in racks just inside the turret. And in fact, I could release those if one needed to put down smoke. I don't think we ever actually did that. I don't think we had any bombs.
Now, what was a typical day's routine like when you got yourself settled, got your feet under the table, so to speak?
Yeah. We used to get up at what I now regard as being a rather gentlemanly hour of about 7:15, and we had breakfast in the mess. And first, there was a first parade every morning of the squadron, which was a squadron parade, when all the troops assembled outside the squadron HQ, and various orders were read out then as to who was going to do what, and a roll was called according to who was on sick parade, all the usual sort of paraphernalia. It wasn't necessarily attended by all the troop commanders, and certainly not always by the squadron leader. Either the squadron leader or the 2IC of the squadron usually took the parade, but there were certainly times when lowly subalterns like myself took the parade, in fact, when there was nobody more senior to do so. That lasted, I think, about half an hour, after which, on a normal day, we would then all go over to the tank park and get to work on the tanks. I had to spend a certain amount of time in the squadron office filling in forms, so I've got reminiscences of various numbers like 857s and 413s, and I, quite honestly, I can't remember what they were. I think the 857 was the record of the tank and where it moved and how many miles it did and what it was doing. The 413, I think, was the petrol return, something like that. And we used to have to write these things up at the end of each week to say what we'd done, and inevitably we were always behind schedule with them. So there was quite a lot of paperwork to do on things like that. But most of the time, on a normal day, I would also go over to the tank park, and I would supervise some of the repair work, although I was certainly not an expert, and not particularly meant to be expert, but to understand what needed doing, and to make arrangements for how it could be done. But I did toolkit inspections, and we had to make sure that stuff wasn't being pinched and that people weren't siphoning off petrol and all these sort of things, and so on and so forth. But I am saying it again. I didn't spend a lot of time up there. I mean, I was able to skive off from the tank park quite a lot and go off and do other things. It was very hot up there. And
so what else would you go and do? Or were they non-military things?
Very little, to be honest with you. I mean, I'm trying to portray a routine day like you asked me to. And one often found oneself back lying on one's bed having a kip for an hour or reading and so on. And work used to, there was very little work in the afternoon, particularly in the summer and the very hot weather. And we used to play, there was an enormous amount of sport went on. We played tennis, we played rugby, we played cricket, all at the same time of the year in the winter months. I mean, these things started sort of October to March when it was the weather was more bearable. Not much of this happened in the summer months when, after all, the summer months, day after day, the temperature was 95 degrees Fahrenheit, the humidity was 90%, And the nights went down to about 70, 75, something like that. But it was very hot, so not a lot really happened in the afternoon. I mean, it is true to say that a tank became untouchable by about 11 o'clock in the morning, the outside metalwork on it. I mean, it really became so hot, you couldn't do an awful lot. So we used to do a lot of nothing very much, you know, a lot of the time. And in fact, one took every opportunity to do nothing if possible.
So after the afternoon would be either line about or sport.
Yeah, we had a...
Depending on the time of year.
That's right. We had a sort of... there wasn't a formal siesta session or anything like that when everybody knocked off. But you didn't do very much in the afternoon. Played tennis at about 4 o'clock.
So after the afternoon break?
In the evening? Well, again, on a normal day, you would go to the mess at about 6 o'clock, have a couple of pink gins and supper, and then play bridge. I played bridge nearly every night of my life out there, I think, with fellow officers, which was great, which was a lot of fun. We played cricket on the lawn outside where our billet was, with a tennis ball and a bat and things, you know, fooling about sort of stuff and things like that.
So what was the mess life like? I mean, can you describe the officer's mess?
It was a huge Nissen hut, basically. It was a Nissen hut shaped, but it had a concrete wall at the front end, and it had quite a reasonable doorway painted white, and we had the regimental flag in the middle of a little bit of garden outside in front of it, which flew all the time, and a sort of gravel drive around it, so it looked as smart as it possibly could. But the anteroom was had a false ceiling in it, so that it wasn't curved Nissen-shaped. And it had big fans, of course, in the middle of it and things like that. Nice, easy chairs and a carpet and a little bar in the corner. And we had a Chinese barman called Leo, who was about 96, I should think. He was a splendid character. And then through the anteroom was a... I think the Nissen hut went the other way. It was almost a T-shaped Nissen hut, as far as I can remember. And the dining room, which was probably as big as the anteroom, which had a table which could comfortably seat 50 or 60 people for a mess night. Nice, shiny, conventional, shiny walnut table or whatever it was, or mahogany probably, and decent chairs and a carpet. And we had photographs around the walls and some nice pictures up, and it was as civilized as it could be. The kitchens were obviously off the dining room, run entirely by Chinese labor. We had a mess sergeant called Sergeant O'Toole, who looked after the Chinese crew, who did all the cooking and kept the place clean. And it was quite civilized. So no air conditioning or anything like that. We had fans, but it was very hot in there. No. We had a radio.
Now, what was a typical guest night like, or mess night?
Well, formal. I mean, we wore white monkey jackets and looked very smart, with black bow ties and white shirts and our blues or patrols trousers. And it was formal to the extent of it depending on how important the chief guest was, I think. If we had the brigadier, we had a Brigadier Urquhart, who was the brigadier of 35 Brigade, which was our brigade, and if he came to dinner, it was a pretty formal evening, and the colonel would announce when dinner was served and we were going into dinner, and one of us subalterns would be nominated Mr. Vice for the night and sit down at the far end of the table. And at the prescribed moment for the loyal toast, the colonel would shout out Mr. Vice, and Mr. Vice would get up and propose the health of the Queen, as she had just then become. Depending, again, on who the guests were, sometimes there were the usual lunatic, rowdy games afterwards until far into the night, very rough games. I can't remember the names of them, but everybody knows what they were.
Do you remember them? What were
Well, I can remember one
what
where...
What did you do? I know you don't.
I can remember one where everybody bent down in behind the chap in front, and you had to leap onto the back of this growing chain of officers and leap along over the top of them and reach the wall at the far end. The worst game was the one when an officer decided that he would climb into the big fan in the middle of the room, and then it would be switched on, and to see how fast he could go around on the fan, which of course didn't go very fast with him on it, but they used to go at a horrifyingly fast rate. I'm not prepared to say whether anybody was actually sick doing it. I certainly never did it myself. And there was a good game where you had to go around the walls of the room without touching the carpet. This is a famous one with which you're obviously familiar, which was quite difficult. And quite a lot of blood could get spilt occasionally on some of these rough games. I can't remember. I didn't enjoy them very much, I must say. I wasn't particularly brave about things like that. I wasn't one of the ringleaders.
Was it a friendly mess once you'd settled in?
Once I'd settled in, yes, very. I mean, there were one or two blokes who I took an instant dislike to, who were not hospitable, who treated one as a bit of dirt, you know, who'd come, particularly some of the younger regular officers, senior lieutenants and junior captains. But that phase passed very quickly, and in fact, I found I made a lot of friends very quickly, and the longer it went on, the more fun that became. I met a lot of very nice people, and we all used to go off together or separately and do things. I mean, never necessarily with the same two or three. I mean, there are lots of mentions in my diary of going down into Hong Kong with different people on different occasions, not necessarily the same chaps all the time. There were one or two, obviously there were a few there who I'd been at Mons with. There was one chap who I went out with on the Asturias, who I knew very well indeed, of course, by that time. There were a couple of chaps arrived who I had been at school with, who were junior to me, because they were a bit later on, who I got to re-know quite well. And but the senior officers were very hospitable. I mean, and the married ones would make a point of asking in turn some of the junior subalterns to their homes for a meal, to meet their wives and usually had young children, I mean, not eligible daughters, because they were only in their 30s themselves, these chaps, you know, I suppose, 30s or 40s, some of them. But one had a weekend with the colonel, and he went round all the subalterns, having a weekend with two or three of the subalterns, of course, you know, which was a part of his duty, I suppose, but it was done very nicely, and my squadron leader was a very good friend, and one used to play bridge with the majors occasionally and people like that, and they'd all mix up quite well in the middle. I mean, it's true to say that apart from the colonel, rank more or less stopped in the mess. I mean, what you did, if you were sitting in the mess and the two IC came in, everybody would stand up and sort of stand to attention to him, and he'd say, "Sit down, please, gentlemen," and you'd then carry on. But that was a nice little formal touch, just to recognise the two IC. Certainly that happened when the colonel came, which wasn't very often. He didn't come in too often. Rather like the captain of a ship doesn't go in the wardroom, you know. I mean, the colonel only appeared on certain occasions.
Now, what about drinking habits? Was it a hard drinking mess? Or
yes, I think so. Whether more so than others, I don't know, but bearing in mind I was 18 and a half, I mean, I drank a lot of gin, a lot of beer, San Miguel beer, which is marvellous stuff, which you can now get here, of course. I couldn't afford it. My mess bill, I hope you don't ask me what my pay was, because you probably will, but I can't remember. But I know that I always had enough just to pay my best mess bill at the end of the month, which I think was about $220. The dollar, I think, was one and threepence in those days, so you can work that out, what that actually meant in real money. I don't know how much, but I smoked a lot, I drank a lot, and I, because I didn't have much money, I didn't go down into Hong Kong and Kowloon very often, although one did.
What was the trip to Hong Kong? That's Hong Kong Island, is it?
Yes, our first port of call was Kowloon, which is the major city on the New Territories side, and that's a huge, huge place. And And that was where we and the services club was in Kowloon, and which had a good swimming pool and things like that, and a lot of cinemas and all sorts of, and some very good restaurants and a big hotel called the Peninsula, known as the Pen. And this is where the Star Ferry went across to the island. Well, we didn't go across to the island quite so much. The island was more expensive, generally speaking. Most of the nightclubs were on the island, the Yacht Club, of course, Government House, and all those sort of places. All the best hotels were on the island. We didn't go across there quite so often, and didn't go across to the other side of the island very often, because taxis, which were extremely cheap, were too expensive for the likes of me. I didn't go everywhere by taxi. I went on a tram occasionally.
So that's typical. Now, so how did your time develop? I mean, did you form a good relationship with your troop? That's always very important.
Yes, I did. I think I got it just about right too. I mean, my troop sergeant, Sergeant White. Was a splendid character, and I got to know him quite well quite early on, and we had the usual informal arrangement whereby he virtually ran the troop, because he was a regular and he knew all the fun, and there was no question of me bossing him about, certainly not in front of the others. And he played the game of looking up to me as his boss in front of the blokes. And that game was settled down very nicely, and we respected each other, and it worked well. I mean, he understood my position. I mean, I'm 18 and a half, you know, he was probably 30 or something, and a married man with a couple of children and so on. But most of the troopers, Lance Corporal and troopers, were about the same age as me. They joined the army at the same time, of course, and so they were. Again, they varied in quality. The sense of humour amongst them was tremendous. They were nice blokes. We got on very well, and I think I avoided over familiarisation, and I think I avoided being bossy and stupid. I mean, but when one had to be, I think I got it about right. And we had, I think, the morale in my troop was as good as any in the regiment, and we did pretty well on the sort of inevitable inter-troop competitions that went on. I mean, their standard of cleanliness was good. We had to inspect them about every fortnight with their trousers dropped to see if they'd got VD and things like that, you know, and that was always taken in the spirit intended.
Was there a problem with VD? Not
a major one. I mean, it was common. There were quite a lot of the blokes had it. I've never heard of an officer having it, but maybe they were able to keep quiet about it. I don't know. I certainly didn't get it. But it wasn't talked about, because it wasn't a rare event. You know, I mean, there were two or three blokes in every troop probably got a packet every so often, and they were sent off to the MO and sprayed with gentian of violet and so on, and then they got better. I don't think anybody ever died of it or had anything really, any serious problem.
What about the sort of exercises you did? Or was there an exercise season? I mean, how did training progress through the year? I think that's probably the best way to.
I didn't arrive particularly at the beginning of a training season and such. If anything, I probably arrived at the beginning of the off season, because I arrived in March when it was beginning to get very hot, and I think less happened in May, June, July and August than any other months of the year because of the heat. But there were exercise. I suppose we had an exercise of some sort about once a month. I remember the first one. Actually, there was one 3 days after I arrived, and because I hadn't really taken over my troop at that point, and they said, "What are we going to do with Berry?" And they said, "I know, we'll make Berry an umpire." So I was issued with a white armband and a jeep, and I was told to umpire the exercise. Of course, I had no idea of the geography of the new territories at all. I had very little idea of what the task was of the people taking part in the exercise. I have no idea who was meant to be advancing and who was meant to be retiring and who was meant to be killing who. And it was a complete farce. But it did. It helped me learn the geography of the new territories very quickly, of course, because I went charging around in this jeep for 3 or 4 days and trying to look efficient and being a good umpire, but it was absolutely clueless. But that was the only time I was an umpire. But when our own exercises started, they were either on a troop basis, on a squadron basis, on a regimental basis, occasionally on a brigade basis, and even the whole of the colony occasionally, or on, if you like, on a divisional basis.
Now, what were the exercises like at these levels?
Pretty pathetic, actually. I mean, they weren't well organised, they weren't well run. You didn't really know what you were meant to be doing. And I mean, I remember thinking at the time, my God, if we actually have to go to war in this place against the Chinese communists, I really began to wonder sometimes what would happen, you know. I mean, now whether that was my fault or not, I don't know. But I think the feeling is fairly general. One went through the motions on an exercise. You were more concerned about finding a Chinese coolie who was selling bottles of Watson's Orange that were nice and cold out in the middle of the stick somewhere than you were about which way your gun was facing, if you like, you know, and things like that. We did exercises. We did some the better exercises were when we did tanks supporting infantry. In other words, when we were working with other units. And we had some illustrious units out there. We had a battalion of the Norfolks, we had a battalion of the Dorsets, who I got to know quite well. We worked a lot with the Dorsets. There was a battalion of the Welsh Regiment there as well, and there were some Kings, but I don't know what Kings they were, whether they were Cosbys or what, I'm not quite sure, but we just called them Kings. And there were artillery units, of course, as well. So when you were working with other units, then you pulled the finger out rather more because you wanted to make sure your regiment didn't look sloppy or silly next to the Dorsets, and they were behaving similarly. But when we were working on our own, it was pretty lackadaisical stuff.
And what would you actually do on an exercise, a typical exercise, or what do you remember?
Take the tanks out to one of the training areas. Rush about all over the place in the tanks, find a place to lager at night, put all the tents up and so on, get the lorry out with the officers' mess stuff in the back of it, and bed down as early as possible. Hope that there wasn't going to be anything silly happening in the middle of the night at 3 o'clock in the morning, just to sort of put us on our mettle, which didn't usually happen. And the next morning, one would get up and go on doing the same sort of things. I mean, I can remember some specific occasions, but I'm trying to, as I say, I'm trying to generalise.
did you fire much? Fire your guns?
Only once in the whole year I was there. Ammunition, I suppose, was either short or very expensive. But we only fired the big gun once. We went on a special range, obviously, to do that. Where the artillery used it as well, and so on, where there was a big hill about 2 miles away, and you couldn't shoot over it, obviously. But we only had, I think, yes, in the whole year I was there, we only had one morning, I think, of shooting the big gun. And Beezer, don't remember shooting the Beezer at all. I suppose we did, but I don't remember it.
And no. So these exercises, not very realistic, not terribly beneficial in your view?
No, they were really there to exercise the blokes, get them out of the regimental lines, get them into the tanks, get them thinking about other things and so on. But I can't remember formal tactics being discussed. I can't remember exercises, although there must have been so, when we actually had formal O groups and orders issued, you know, to given and discussed and so on, and we certainly did a certain amount of map reading and so on, but it was pretty disjointed stuff. One of the reasons for that, I think, was because the tanks never worked properly. I mean, you know, if you've got a squadron of 13 tanks and they're all in tip-top order and all working well, you can do an awful lot, have a lot more fun and games doing things with them than the fact that you wake up in the morning and the three tanks you had the day before, you're down to one, and you're worried about trying, spend half the morning trying to get the other two started. You know, that's the sort of thing that happened out on schemes, and it was difficult.